What did Pope Alexander VI and his 1493 Doctrine of Discovery have to do with the massacre of American Indians in 1870?
The Doctrine of Discovery really allowed a European country to go into any country that didn't have the same religion, the same language, and declare perhaps that the land was terra nullius, which meant worthless land, and they could take it over. And that was a result of a papal doctrine.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Paul R. Wiley about his historical account of the 1870 massacre of innocent pagan Indians by the 2nd Cavalry. His book is titled Blood on the Marias, The Baker Massacre. What was the U.S. Army's version of what happened at Heavy Runner's Camp near the Marias River on the 23rd of January, 1870?
The Army's version was that they had attacked the right camp and not the wrong camp, and they were supposed to attack Mountain Chief's camp. Soon after, their reports didn't even mention Heavy Runner. They mentioned him once. And his name never again appeared to have be in any of the Army reports. So their version was that it was a battle, this was a great military victory, and that's what they proclaimed for a while, but it didn't last. Soon they got all sorts of criticism and investigation.
They also claimed a certain number of people killed and claimed that there were a lot more warriors.
That's correct. The Army and Major Baker claimed that they'd killed basically all warriors and let the women and children go. But then it turned out that they may have killed very few warriors, and most of the people in the camp were women and children. Young boys below fighting age, and old men.
And this was, as we said, in January, in the middle of winter, so even if they did let the women and children go, they were out there and it was below zero. They had no provisions. The Army burned all of their lodges and their possessions.
Yes, they did let the women and children go. And their story was that since the tribe had smallpox, that they couldn't bring them in, and so they had to let them go. But according to the Army, they were sure that the survivors would be picked up by other members of their tribe or other friendly tribes. The second part of that is that the Army did burn the lodges or teepees and the robes that had been collected in that camp, but as we get on later in the book, after the battle, I discuss what might have happened to those robes, and it appears like there's at least a circumstantial case that the Army didn't burn the robes, that they got into the hands of the fur and whiskey traders.
And we're talking about bison robes, buffalo.
Yes.
That's the Army version. And what was the Blackfeet version of who was killed and how many were killed?
The best Blackfeet version was given, I think, by Joe Kipp, and I believe he counted 213 killed. That's substantially more than the Army's official version of 173 killed.
Mostly women and children, it seems.
Yes, mostly women and children. And Joe Kipp himself did pick up some of the survivors, the young children, and many of them Heavy Runner's children, and of course they're are many Kips in the Blackfeet tribe now that is in Browning.
And let's talk about Joe Kipp and the two other men that were guides. They were hired to guide Baker and his men to Mountain Chief's camp, to the correct camp. They're looking for several men who had killed Malcolm Clark. And so they were sent out there in the middle of winter to surprise the camp and find those men. And those three guides each seemed to have an agenda that you uncovered.
Well, they did. Joe Kipp himself was a young man, 21 years old, but he was an experienced fur trader and did engage to some extent in the whiskey trade, I'm sure. And he was hired for his knowledge of the Piegan Indians and where their winter camps might be. There is a question, though, as to whether or not he was totally objective in trying to find Mountain Chief's camp. He may have known it was Heavy Runner's camp. At the last moment, it's clear that he did know it was Heavy Runner's camp they were going to attack, and he tried to persuade Major Baker not to attack, but Baker wouldn't listen to him. The other seemingly duplicity in the whole thing is the hiring of Joe Cobell as a guide to assist Kipp. And they may have operated independently, but Joe Cobell was married to a daughter of Mountain Chief, and Heavy Runner apparently had taken some livestock from Cobell's ranch. And when I say Heavy Runner, I don't mean himself. I mean members of his band. And as the book will tell us, Joe Cobell probably fired the shot that killed Heavy Runner himself.
As Heavy Runner was holding his paper that had just been given to him to prove who he was.
Yes, that paper is very significant in this whole thing, because General Alfred Sully was also in the territory, but he wasn't in the Army at that time. He was in the Department of the Interior in the Indian Affairs Department, and he'd been sent to Montana as the Indian superintendent. And he had different views of what should be done from those pronounced by General de Trobriand and the rest of the regular army. Sully thought that he could negotiate with the Indians and get them to bring in the murderers of Malcolm Clark, and he had such a negotiation on the Teton River at the Blackfeet Agency before the battle, and the only Indian chief who came in, actually there were two of them, but one was Heavy Runner, and they were given what one might call a peace paper. And no one really knows what this paper was, but apparently it was a safe passage paper that would say that Heavy Runner was peaceful. When Heavy Runner went out of his teepee to talk to the soldiers who'd come into his camp, he was shot by Joe Cobell.
Is shot with the paper in his hand, which is what makes it all the more poignant. There was one other guide, and he had to have an agenda.
Horace Clark definitely had an agenda. The whole uproar started in Montana in August when Malcolm Clark, Horace's father, was lured out of his cabin and murdered by Pete Owlchild, a son of Mountain Chief. And so was Horace, who was shot and left for dead, but he survived. So Horace had revenge in his heart.
So you said that this inciting incident, as we call it in literature, happened in August. Explain why the troops were trying to chase down these outlaws in January and where they came from and what they had to go through to get to Heavy Runner's camp or any place in Montana at that time of year.
These people weren't really in the area where the Indians were on the Marias.
No, they were 200 miles away.
200 very hard miles. Winter attacks were one of the strategies of the Army because they thought the tribe would be settled down in their winter places. And for the Piegan Indians, that was on the Marias River. It depended somewhat on the buffalo, but if the buffalo were there, they would stay there. And so the idea was to use stealth and steal upon this band of Indians on the Marias River. To do that, they took an eight-day ride from Fort Ellis to Fort Shaw outside of present-day Great Falls, and then they took about five more days to get up to the Marias River. And at all times, the temperature was below zero from any record that I can find.
And they were sleeping outside with no tents. I mean, the conditions just sounded awful.
They probably had tents between Fort Ellis and Fort Shaw, but after that, they actually rode at night so they wouldn't be detected, and they could only take with them their saddle blankets and their horses and armaments. And so, yes, they were sleeping outside during the daytime. We are told by the records that they couldn't even make coffee because they'd have to start a fire.
So they were trying not to be detected so that nobody would warn the camp that they were coming.
That was the plan anyway, and that was a typical military tactic from what I understand.
So the point I'm trying to make is that there are these men who are traveling in the winter. They're trying to sleep during the day. They're freezing. They just want to get this thing over with. And so when they think they've come to the camp that they're supposed to attack, their leader is drunk, their guides are duplicitous, but they have a job to do, and they just want to get it done and get back to where it's warm.
I think that has to be right. They went there with a fight in their minds. And in the case of one of the company commanders, Gustavus Cheney Doan, he was the youngest company commander of the 2nd Cavalry stationed at Fort Ellis, and he was only third in command in the company. The two ahead of him couldn't make the trip. So here's this young company commander, and for some reason, Baker had recovered from his inebriation enough to send Doan first down the river to try to find Mountain Chief's camp. And of course, what Doan found was Heavy Runner's camp. So here's a very inexperienced young man, but we know from other writings that he was a very ambitious young man. He wanted to be known as an Indian fighter, and he attacked the village.
And so he was all gung-ho to get the glory. We tend to look at a massacre and say, what a terrible thing, and these people that perpetrated the crime, as we see it later, must have been awful. So I'm not trying to defend the army. I'm just saying there's more to see here. There were things going on both sides.
That's quite true. The army at that time was the army, of course, and they had a recent tradition of the Civil War when I think 640,000 people were killed. That's a total from both sides. So killing was not that far from the mind, I think, of any soldier who was set out in the plains that had been connected with the Civil War, as had Major Baker and as had Colonel de Trobriand. So, you know, there's a bit of mentality there. It was sort of a killing mentality. And there was a lot of heroism associated with that, I think. And a young man like Doan was in the army. He wanted to advance. He wanted to get a reputation as an Indian fighter. And this is what he did.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Paul R. Wiley about his latest book, Blood on the Marias, The Baker Massacre. Funding for The Right Question is provided by MTPR members and by Humanities Montana. In fact, Humanities Montana has been supporting us since 2008, and we are so grateful. Their support funds our podcast, and you'll find a link to that at mtpr.org. You can also listen to this program again or share it with a friend from our blog, which you'll also find at mtpr.org, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be back to find out more about what was going on behind the scenes, both with the army and the people in the village they attacked. Don't go away. Thank you. the U.S. Army was sent to the Montana Territory to protect settlers from Indians, but wasn't there also a mandate to protect the Indian reservations from the settlers?
There was, and I think I've quoted perhaps General William Tecumseh Sherman in the book on this. His policy as the top general in the Army was basically to get the Indians on reservations where they would be safe and actually could be protected from white incursions. But if they were off the reservations, they were fair game. The problem with the Piegan tribe was they had no reservation. The boundaries had never been set. They were granted large areas of Montana as exclusive hunting grounds very early on, and those areas were overrun by the cities, Virginia City, Helena, whatever. But they still had no defined reservation where they could say they were safe. And so in one sense, they were already on their reservation, and in another sense, they weren't. And there's a history of treaties that is in the book.
Yes, a history of treaties that's fascinating to read because it brings in all kinds of personalities and situations. And your book details centuries of social and political policies that laid the groundwork for this particular massacre. And there's a short passage that begins on page 65 where you wrote about a period during the mid-1860s when tensions were escalating in Blackfeet territory, and I'd like you to read that if you don't mind.
All right. The tribes of the Blackfeet Nation in the more northern extremes of the Montana Territory were having ongoing troubles with the whites. A number of white trappers were still in the area, and the fur trading tribes wanted them out of their territory. Also upsetting to the Indians was the appearance of wagon trains of settlers. James Liberty Fisk had established a new immigration trail from Minnesota to Fort Benton. The wagon trains were bothersome because they ran through Indian country from the mouth of the Milk River to Fort Benton. The Blackfeet tribe proper, the Gros Ventres and Piegans, all remained at peace at that time. The Bloods were of a different mind. Trouble started in December 1864 when a band of 14 Bloods stole the horses of 20 white trappers who were hunting near the Little Rocky Mountains, a small range north of the Missouri. Nine of the trappers overtook the Bloods at daylight, killed two of them, and recovered the stolen horses. In April 1865, the Bloods stole 40 horses from Fort Benton. On May 10, they stole all the horses and mules from the government farm on the Sun River that had been set up by Agent Alfred Vaughn to instruct the Indians on farming. On May 22, a party of drunken white men at Fort Benton retaliated by attacking a party of Bloods there and killed three of them. 3 days later, a large party of Bloods attacked 10 white men who were cutting logs on the Marias River and killed them all. According to Lieutenant James H. Bradley of the Army, who gathered accounts of historical events in his journals, the real trouble began when a party of Blood Indians destroyed a party of 9 white men and 1 Negro at the mouth of the Marias on May 25, 1865. These hostilities were all confined to a small group of Bloods whose homes were properly in British America. Gad E. Upson was 40 years old when he was sent in 1863 to the Montana Territory to take up his position as Blackfeet agent. He had soldiered in Mexico and then as part of a mercenary filibustering expedition against Cuba. After working for a time in the Department of the Interior, he was sent to Montana as Blackfeet agent. Once there, he added other sideline interest and acquired gold mining claims in the Virginia City area, 200 miles away, and formed the Upson and Clark Mining Company to process ore. He had also run in the 1865 election for the single seat as Montana Territorial Delegate to Congress on the Unionist ticket, only to suffer defeat at the hands of the Democratic incumbent Samuel McLean. Gad Upson did not think highly of the Indians that he supervised. He believed that encounters with white settlers, as he said, had a tendency to create in their ignorant minds a jealousy and prejudice against the whites, amounting in several instances to open hostilities and resulting in bloodshed to both parties. citing intertribal wars, disease, and moral decay, Upson predicted that but a few years will elapse before all but a remnant of what they once were will have passed to their last hunting grounds to return no more forever.
That idea of Native people returning no more was a big part of Major Baker's philosophy as a fighter. His motto was, "Nits make lice." So how do you think that played out when they got to the Marias River and attacked Heavy Runner's camp?
I think extermination, if not a primary goal, was certainly high on the list of alternatives as a way to handle the Indians. And I think that's present throughout the book in different places, that the Indians will eventually simply be obliterated and then won't be a problem. And unfortunately, that came from some of the highest levels.
It was so complicated. I mean, as you just read there, these guys kill these guys, so we go kill them, and back and forth. And that seems to be how wars start. But it was just ongoing. And yet the settlers kept coming.
The settlers came basically for gold. And then agriculture was also starting at that time. But mostly it was for gold, and the gold camps were fairly well protected. We're talking now about Virginia City, Helena, Diamond City, all with thousands of gold miners there, and they could protect themselves from the Indians. What couldn't be protected were the trade routes between the gold camps and the trade route from Fort Benton, where goods came in, off the Missouri and were shipped by freighter down to Helena and Virginia City and Confederate Gulch.
So when those wagons loaded with goods were out there with only a few men around, that's when they were attacked.
That seems to be the case, and that seemed to have particularly been the case in the months and year preceding the Baker Massacre.
But back to the Blackfeet. Part of the tribe did have a reservation over near what is now the east side of Glacier National Park. But once their land was established, then a railroad was proposed to come through and roads were built. And so it seemed to me like those people were trying to protect their own land. And then the army was trying to protect the settlers, but they were also trying to keep the Indians' land from being overrun by the settlers. So it just was complicated on all sides.
You know, that reservation boundary concept was a shifting concept. Originally in 1851, the reservation or the land set out for the Blackfeet were actually south of the Missouri River, and they came all the way down to Yellowstone Park. And then on the west side of the Yellowstone River, up until the Shields River joined it, which was then called 25 Yard Creek, and up that creek to the Musselshell River, and that separated the Blackfeet from the Crows. But they were given nothing north of the Missouri River, which is where their traditional hunting ground was. At that time, the government was very concerned about Indian attacks on the immigration routes to the West Coast, and I think they wanted to reserve that for a railway. That was corrected somewhat by an 1855 Lame Deer Treaty that's discussed in the book, and there are maps of all these reservation lands in the book. Finally, those reservation lands shrunk to the point where they are today, and of course this is way after the time frame that the book covers, but the Blackfeet Reservation is now about 70 or 75 miles away from the Marias River Massacre site.
And the gold is what made governing the Montana Territory attractive to the people controlling the money in Washington.
It did very much. The government was basically running out of funds after the Civil War. It was very expensive.
What was the biggest thing you learned about Montana during the process of researching and writing this book?
I think basically it was the founding of Montana and what type of people came and the hardships that the people endured. It wasn't all Indian hardships. It was also hardships of the settlers and the gold miners. And they endured long, hard winters. They endured shortage of food supply. They endured Indian attacks. But yet they persevered and they stayed here. And of course, the glue was the gold.
So let's end with hearing you read a passage that just gives us a little snapshot of the aftermath of the massacre.
Okay. One of the things that became evident to me is that the soldiers certainly could have done something to help the survivors, but they basically did nothing. And there's one particularly poignant story in the book about a spear woman who was a young child and saw the members of her family and her band being killed by the soldiers. Afterwards, she escaped. This is what I have in the book. As the soldiers had headed back to Fort Shaw, they were unaware that a small group was following them. It included Spear Woman, the little girl who stayed hidden as the Pagans were massacred in her lodge. She and her surviving siblings were with their mother, who had decided to follow the soldiers at a distance where they could not be seen. They were starving, and their purpose was to find food left in the soldiers' camp after they had moved on. The little family group camped each night without a fire, and each morning would go into the deserted soldiers' camp looking for any scraps of food, a search that yielded but bits of hardtack and bacon. On these forays, the mother had to leave Spear Woman's infant sister behind. When they returned from one of their scavenging trips, they found the baby girl dead in a snowbank. They continued on until they reached the top of a hill from where they could see Fort Benton in the distance. They could also see a camp of friendly Pagans nearby who took them in.
Paul R. Wiley lives in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about him and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. And on our blog, you will find children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you scads of fascinating books and a whole lot of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.